exchanges and parliaments with the harshest criticism, don't have a viable alternative model for running the world. While it is a favourite pastime of Western academics and activists to find fault with the liberal package, they have so far failed to come up with anything better. China seems to offer a much more serious challenge than Western social protesters. Despite liberalizing its politics and economics, China is neither a democracy nor a truly free market economy, which does not prevent it from becoming the economic giant of the 21st century. Yet this economic giant casts a very small ideological shadow. Nobody seems to know what the Chinese believe these days, including the Chinese themselves. In theory, China is still communist, but in practice, it is nothing of the kind. Some Chinese thinkers and leaders toy with a return to Confucianism, but that's hardly more than a convenient veneer. This ideological vacuum makes China the most promising breeding ground for the new techno-religions emerging from Silicon Valley, which we will discuss in the following chapters. But these techno-religions, with their belief in immortality and virtual paradises, would take at least a decade or two to establish themselves. Hence, at present, China doesn't pose a real alternative to liberalism. If bankrupted Greeks despair of the liberal model and search for a substitute, imitating the Chinese doesn't mean much. How about radical Islam, then? Or fundamentalist Christianity, messianic Judaism and revivalist Hinduism? Whereas the Chinese don't know what they believe, religious fundamentalists know it only too well. More than a century after Nietzsche pronounced him dead, God seems to be making a comeback. But this is a mirage. God is dead. It just takes a while to get rid of the body. Radical Islam poses no serious threat to the liberal package, because, for all their fervour, the zealots don't really understand the world of the 21st century, and have nothing relevant to say about the novel dangers and opportunities that new technologies are generating all around us. Religion and technology always dance a delicate tango. They push one another, depend on one another, and cannot stray too far away from one another. Technology depends on religion, because every invention has many potential applications, and the engineers need some profit to make the crucial choice and point towards the required destination. Thus, in the 19th century, engineers invented locomotives, radios, and internal combustion engines. But as the 20th century proved, you can use these very same tools to create fascist societies, communist dictatorships, and liberal democracies. Without some religious convictions, the locomotives cannot decide where to go. On the other hand, technology often defines the scope and limits of our religious visions, like a waiter that demarcates our appetites by handing us a menu. New technologies kill old gods and give birth to new gods. That's why agricultural deities were different from hunter-gatherer spirits, why factory hands fantasize about different paradises than peasants, and why the revolutionary technologies of the 21st century are far more likely to spawn unprecedented religious movements than to revive medieval creeds. Islamic fundamentalists may repeat the mantra that Islam is the answer, but religions that lose touch with the technological realities of the day lose their ability even to understand the questions being asked. What will happen to the job market once artificial intelligence outperforms humans in most cognitive tasks? What will be the political impact of a massive new class of economically useless people? What will happen to relationships, families, and pension funds when nanotechnology and regenerative medicine turn 80 into the new 50? What will happen to human society when biotechnology enables us to have designer babies and to open unprecedented gaps between rich and poor? You will not find the answers to any of these questions in the Quran or Sharia law, nor in the Bible or in the Confucian Analects, because nobody in the medieval Middle East or in ancient China knew much about computers, genetics, or nanotechnology. Radical Islam may promise an anchor of certainty in a world of technological and economic storms, but in order to navigate a storm, you need a map and a rudder rather than just an anchor. Hence, radical Islam may appeal to people born and raised in its fold, but it has precious little to offer unemployed Spanish youths or anxious Chinese billionaires. True, hundreds of millions may nevertheless go on believing in Islam, Christianity, or Hinduism. But numbers alone don't count for much in history. History is often shaped by small groups of forward-looking innovators, rather than by the backward-looking masses. 10,000 years ago, most people were hunter-gatherers, and only a few pioneers in the Middle East were farmers. Yet the future belonged to the farmers. In 1850, more than 90% of humans were peasants, and in the small villages along the Ganges, the Nile, and the Yangtze, nobody knew anything about steam engines, railroads, or telegraph lines. Yet the fate of these peasants had already been sealed in Manchester and Birmingham by the handful of engineers, politicians, and financiers who spearheaded the Industrial Revolution. Steam engines, railroads, and telegraphs transformed the production of food, textiles, vehicles, and weapons, giving industrial powers a decisive edge over traditional agricultural societies. Even when the Industrial Revolution spread around the world and penetrated up the Ganges, Nile, and Yangtze, most people continued to believe in the Vedas, the Bible, the Quran, and the Analects more than in the steam engine. As today, so too in the 19th century there was no shortage of priests, mystics, and gurus who argued that they alone hold the solution to all of humanity's woes, including to the new problems created by the Industrial Revolution. For example, between the 1820s and 1880s, Egypt, backed by Britain, conquered Sudan and tried to modernize the country and incorporate it into the new international trade network. This destabilized traditional Sudanese society, creating widespread resentment and fostering revolts. In 1881, a local religious leader, Muhammad Ahmad bin Abdallah, declared that he was the Mahdi, the Messiah, sent to establish the law of God on earth. His supporters defeated the Anglo-Egyptian army and beheaded its commander, General Charles Gordon, in a gesture that shocked Victorian Britain. They then established in Sudan an Islamic theocracy, governed by Sharia law, which lasted until 1898. Meanwhile, in India, Dayananda Saraswati headed a Hindu revival movement, whose basic principle was that the Vedic scriptures are never wrong. In 1875, he founded the Arya Samaj, noble society, dedicated to the spreading of Vedic knowledge, though, truth be told, Dayananda often interpreted the Vedas in a surprisingly liberal way, supporting, for example, equal rights for women long before the idea became popular in the West. Dayananda's contemporary, Pope Pius IX, had much more conservative views about women, but shared Dayananda's admiration for superhuman authority. Pius led a series of reforms in Catholic dogma and established the novel principle of papal infallibility, according to which the Pope can never err in matters of faith. This seemingly medieval idea became binding Catholic dogma only in 1870, 11 years after Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species. 30 years before the Pope discovered that he is incapable of making mistakes, a failed Chinese scholar called Hong Xiuquan had a succession of religious visions. In these visions, God revealed that Hong was none other than the younger brother of Jesus Christ. God then invested Hong with a divine mission. He told Hong to expel the Manchu demons that had ruled China since the 17th century and establish on earth the great peaceful kingdom of heaven, Taiping Changguo. Hong's message fired the imagination of millions of desperate Chinese, who were shaken by China's defeats in the Opium Wars and by the coming of modern industry and European imperialism. But Hong did not lead them to a kingdom of peace. Rather, he led them against the Manchu Qing dynasty in the Taiping Rebellion, the deadliest war of the 19th century. From 1850 to 1864, at least 20 million people lost their lives, far more than in the Napoleonic Wars or in the American Civil War. Hundreds of millions clung to the religious dogmas of Hong, Dayananda, Pius, and the Mahdi, even as industrial factories, railroads, and steamships filled the world. Yet most of us don't think about the 19th century as the age of faith. When we think of 19th century visionaries, we are far more likely to recall Marx, Engels, and Lenin than the Mahdi, Pius IX, or Hong Xiuquan. And rightly so. Though in 1850 socialism was only a fringe movement, it soon gathered momentum and changed the world in far more profound ways than the self-proclaimed messiahs of China and Sudan. If you count on national health services, pension funds, and free schools, you need to thank Marx and Lenin and Otto von Bismarck far more than Hong Xiuquan or the Mahdi. Why did Marx and Lenin succeed where Hong and the Mahdi failed? Not because socialist humanism was philosophically more sophisticated than Islamic and Christian theology, but rather because Marx and Lenin devoted more attention to understanding the technological and economic realities of their time than to pursuing ancient texts and prophetic dreams. Steam engines, railroads, telegraphs, and electricity created unheard-of problems as well as unprecedented opportunities. The experiences, needs, and hopes of the new class of urban proletariats were simply too different from those of biblical peasants. To answer these needs and hopes, Marx and Lenin studied how a steam engine functions, how a coal mine operates, how railroads shape the economy, and how electricity influences politics. Lenin was once asked to define communism in a single sentence. "Communism is power to worker councils," he said, "plus electrification of the whole country." There can be no communism without electricity, without railroads, without radio. You couldn't establish a communist regime in 16th century Russia because communism necessitates the concentration of information and resources in one hub. From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, only works when produce can easily be collected and distributed across vast distances, and when activities can be monitored and coordinated over entire countries. Marx and his followers understood the new technological realities and the new human experiences, so they had relevant answers to the new problems of industrial society, as well as original ideas about how to benefit from the unprecedented opportunities. The socialists created a brave new religion for a brave new world. They promised salvation through technology and economics, thus establishing the first techno-religion in history and changing the foundations of ideological discourse. Before Marx, people defined and divided themselves according to their views about God, not about production methods. Since Marx, questions of technology and economic structure became far more important and divisive than debates about the soul and the afterlife. In the second half of the 20th century, humankind almost obliterated itself in an argument about production methods. Even the harshest critics of Marx and Lenin adopted their basic attitude towards history and society, and began thinking about technology and production much more carefully than about God and heaven. In the mid-19th century, few people were as perceptive as Marx, hence only a few countries underwent rapid industrialization. These few countries conquered the world. Most societies failed to understand what was happening, and they therefore missed the train of progress. Dayananda's India and the Mahdi's Sudan remained far more preoccupied with God than with steam engines, hence they were occupied and exploited by industrial Britain. Only in the last few years has India managed to make significant progress in closing the economic and geopolitical gap separating it from Britain. Sudan is still struggling far behind. In the early 21st century, the train of progress is again pulling out of the station, and this will probably be the last train ever to leave the station called Homo sapiens. Those who miss this train will never get a second chance. In order to get a seat on it, you need to understand 21st century technology, and in particular the powers of biotechnology and computer algorithms. These powers are far more potent than steam and the telegraph, and they will not be used merely for the production of food, textiles, vehicles, and weapons. The main products of the 21st century will be bodies, brains, and minds, and the gap between those who know how to engineer bodies and brains and those who do not will be far bigger than the gap between Dickens's Britain and the Mahdi's Sudan. Indeed, it will be bigger than the gap between sapiens and Neanderthals. In the 21st century, those who ride the train of progress will acquire divine abilities of creation and destruction, while those left behind will face extinction. Socialism, which was very up-to-date 100 years ago, failed to keep up with the new technology. Leonid Brezhnev and Fidel Castro held on to ideas that Marx and Lenin formulated in the age of steam and did not understand the power of computers and biotechnology. Liberals, in contrast, adapted far better to the information age. This partly explains why Khrushchev's 1956 prediction never materialized, and why it was the liberal capitalists who eventually buried the Marxists. If Marx came back to life today, he would probably urge his few remaining disciples to devote less time to reading Das Kapital and more time to studying the Internet and the human genome. Radical Islam is in a far worse position than socialism. It has not yet even come to terms with the Industrial Revolution. No wonder it has little of relevance to say about genetic engineering and artificial intelligence. Islam, Christianity, and other traditional religions are still important players in the world, yet their role is now largely reactive. In the past, they were a creative force. Christianity, for example, spread the hitherto heretical idea that all humans are equal before God, thereby changing human political structures, social hierarchies, and even gender relations. In his Sermon on the Mount, Jesus went further, insisting that the meek and oppressed are God's favorite people, thus turning the pyramid of power on its head and providing ammunition for generations of revolutionaries. In addition to social and ethical reforms, Christianity was responsible for important economic and technological innovations. The Catholic Church established medieval Europe's most sophisticated administrative system and pioneered the use of archives, catalogues, timetables, and other techniques of data processing. The Vatican was the closest thing 12th-century Europe had to Silicon Valley. The Church established Europe's first economic corporations, the monasteries, which for 1,000 years spearheaded the European economy and introduced advanced agricultural and administrative methods. Monasteries were the first institutions to use clocks, and for centuries they and the cathedral schools were the most important learning centers of Europe, helping to found many of Europe's first universities, such as Bologna, Oxford, and Salamanca. Today the Catholic Church continues to enjoy the loyalties and tithes of hundreds of millions of followers. Yet it and the other theist religions have long since turned from a creative into a reactive force. They are busy with rearguard holding operations more than with pioneering novel technologies, innovative economic methods, or groundbreaking social ideas. They now mostly agonize over the technologies, methods, and ideas propagated by other movements. Biologists invent the contraceptive pill, and the Pope doesn't know what to do about it. Computer scientists develop the Internet, and rabbis argue whether Orthodox Jews should be allowed to surf it. Feminist thinkers call upon women to take possession of their bodies, and learned muftis debate how to confront such incendiary ideas. Ask yourself, what was the most influential discovery, invention, or creation of the 20th century? That's a difficult question, because it is hard to choose from a long list of candidates, including scientific discoveries such as antibiotics, technological inventions such as computers, and ideological creations such as feminism. Now ask yourself, what was the most influential discovery, invention, or creation of traditional religions such as Islam and Christianity in the 20th century? This too is a very difficult question, because there is so little to choose from. What did priests, rabbis, and muftis discover in the 20th century that can be mentioned in the same breath as antibiotics, computers, or feminism? Having mulled over these two questions, from where do you think the big changes of the 21st century will emerge? From the Islamic State or from Google? Yes, the Islamic State knows how to put videos on YouTube, but leaving aside the industry of torture, how many new startups have emerged from Syria or Iraq lately? Billions of people, including many scientists, continue to use religious scriptures as a source of authority, but these texts are no longer a source of creativity. Think, for example, about the acceptance of gay marriage or female clergy by the more progressive branches of Christianity. Where did this acceptance originate? Not from reading the Bible, St. Augustine, or Martin Luther. Rather, it came from reading texts like Michel Foucault's The History of Sexuality, or Donna Haraway's A Cyborg Manifesto. Yet Christian true believers, however progressive, cannot admit to drawing their ethics from Foucault and Haraway. So they go back to the Bible, to St. Augustine and to Martin Luther, and make a very thorough search. They read page after page and story after story with the utmost attention, until they find what they need, some maxim, parable, or ruling, that if interpreted creatively enough, means that God blesses gay marriages, and that women can be ordained to the priesthood. They then pretend the idea originated in the Bible, when in fact it originated with Foucault. The Bible is kept as a source of authority, even though it is no longer a true source of inspiration. That's why traditional religions offer no real alternative to liberalism. Their scriptures don't have anything to say about genetic engineering or artificial intelligence, and most priests, rabbis, and muftis don't understand the latest breakthroughs in biology and computer science. For if you want to understand these breakthroughs, you don't have much choice. You need to spend time reading scientific articles and conducting lab experiments instead of memorizing and debating ancient texts. That doesn't mean liberalism can rest on its laurels. True, it has won the humanist wars of religion, and as of 2016 it has no viable alternative. But its very success may contain the seeds of its ruin. The triumphant liberal ideals are now pushing humankind to reach for immortality, bliss, and divinity. Egged on by the allegedly infallible wishes of customers and voters, scientists and engineers devote more and more energies to these liberal projects. Yet what the scientists are discovering and what the engineers are developing may unwittingly expose both the inherent flaws in the liberal worldview and the blindness of customers and voters. When genetic engineering and artificial intelligence reveal their full potential, liberalism, democracy, and free markets might become as obsolete as flint knives, tape cassettes, Islam, and communism. This book began by forecasting that in the 21st century, humans will try to attain immortality, bliss, and divinity. This forecast isn't very original or far-sighted. It simply reflects the traditional ideals of liberal humanism. Since humanism has long sanctified the life, the emotions, and the desires of human beings, it's hardly surprising that a humanist civilization will want to maximize human lifespans, human happiness, and human power. Yet the third and final part of the book will argue that attempting to realize this humanist dream will undermine its very foundations by unleashing new post-humanist technologies. The humanist belief in feelings has enabled us to benefit from the fruits of the modern covenant without paying its price. We don't need any gods to limit our power and give us meaning. The free choices of customers and voters supply us with all the meaning we require. What then will happen once we realize that customers and voters never make free choices, and once we have the technology to calculate, design, or outsmart their feelings? If the whole universe is pegged to the human experience, what will happen once the human experience becomes just another designable product, no different in essence from any other item in the supermarket? Part 3. Homo sapiens loses control. Can humans go on running the world and giving it meaning? How do biotechnology and artificial intelligence threaten humanism? Who might inherit humankind? And what new religion might replace humanism? Chapter 8. The Time Bomb in the Laboratory. In 2016, the world is dominated by the liberal package of individualism, human rights, democracy, and the free market. Yet 21st century science is undermining the foundations of the liberal order. Because science does not deal with questions of value, it cannot determine whether liberals are right in valuing liberty more than equality, or in valuing the individual more than the collective. However, like every other religion, liberalism too is based on what it believes to be factual statements, in addition to abstract ethical judgments. And these factual statements just don't stand up to rigorous scientific scrutiny. Liberals value individual liberty so much because they believe that humans have free will. According to liberalism, the decisions of voters and customers are neither deterministic nor random. People are, of course, influenced by external forces and chance events, but at the end of the day, each of us can wave the magic wand of freedom and decide things for ourselves. This is the reason liberalism gives so much importance to voters and customers, and instructs us to follow our heart and do what feels good. It is our free will that imbues the universe with meaning, and since no outsider can know how you really feel or predict your choices for you, you shouldn't trust any big brother to look after your interests and desires. Attributing free will to humans is not an ethical judgment. It purports to be a factual description of the world. Although this so-called factual description might have made sense back in the days of Locke, Rousseau, and Thomas Jefferson, it does not sit well with the latest findings of the life sciences. The contradiction between free will and contemporary science is the elephant in the laboratory, whom many prefer not to see as they peer into their microscopes and fMRI scanners. In the 18th century, Homo sapiens was like a mysterious black box whose inner workings were beyond our grasp. Hence, when scholars asked why a man drew a knife and stabbed another to death, an acceptable answer said, because he chose to. He used his free will to choose murder, which is why he is fully responsible for his crime. Over the last century, as scientists opened up the sapiens black box, they discovered there neither soul, nor free will, nor self, but only genes, hormones, and neurons that obey the same physical and chemical laws governing the rest of reality. Today, when scholars ask why a man drew a knife and stabbed someone to death, answering, because he chose to, doesn't cut the mustard. Instead, geneticists and brain scientists provide a much more detailed answer. He did it due to such and such electrochemical processes in the brain, which were shaped by a particular genetic makeup, which reflects ancient evolutionary pressures coupled with chance mutations. The electrochemical brain processes that result in murder are either deterministic or random or a combination of both, but they are never free. For example, when a neuron fires an electric charge, this may either be a deterministic reaction to external stimuli, or it might be the outcome of a random event such as the spontaneous decomposition of a radioactive atom. Neither option leaves any room for free will. Decisions reached through a chain reaction of biochemical events, each determined by a previous event, are certainly not free. Decisions resulting from random subatomic accidents aren't free either. They are just random. And when random accidents combine with deterministic processes, we get probabilistic outcomes. But this, too, doesn't amount to freedom. Suppose we build a robot whose central processing unit is linked to a radioactive lump of uranium. When choosing between two options, say, press the right button or the left button, the robot counts the number of uranium atoms that decayed during the previous minute. If the number is even, it presses the right button. If the number is odd, the left button. We can never be certain about the actions of such a robot. But nobody would call this contraption free, and we wouldn't dream of allowing it to vote in democratic elections or holding it legally responsible for its actions. To the best of our scientific understanding, determinism and randomness have divided the entire cake between them, leaving not even a crumb for freedom. The sacred word freedom turns out to be, just like soul, an empty term that carries no discernible meaning. Free will exists only in the imaginary stories we humans have invented. The last nail in freedom's coffin is provided by the theory of evolution. Just as evolution cannot be squared with eternal souls, neither can it swallow the idea of free will. For if humans are free, How could natural selection have shaped them? According to the theory of evolution, all the choices animals make, whether of residence, food, or mates, reflect their genetic code. If, thanks to its fit genes, an animal chooses to eat a nutritious mushroom and copulate with healthy and fertile mates, these genes pass on to the next generation. If, because of unfit genes, an animal chooses poisonous mushrooms and anemic mates, these genes become extinct. However, if an animal freely chooses what to eat and with whom to mate, then natural selection is left with nothing to work on. When confronted with such scientific explanations, people often brush them aside, pointing out that they feel free and that they act according to their own wishes and decisions. This is true. Humans act according to their desires. If by free will you mean the ability to act according to your desires, then, yes, humans have free will, and so do chimpanzees, dogs, and parrots. When Polly wants a cracker, Polly eats a cracker. But the million-dollar question is not whether parrots and humans can act out their inner desires. The question is whether they can choose their desires in the first place. Why does Polly want a cracker rather than a cucumber? Why do I decide to kill my annoying neighbor instead of turning the other cheek? Why do I want to buy the red car rather than the black? Why do I prefer voting for the Conservatives rather than the Labour Party? I don't choose any of these wishes. I feel a particular wish welling up within me because this is the feeling created by the biochemical processes in my brain. These processes might be deterministic or random, but not free. You might reply that at least in the case of major decisions, such as murdering a neighbor or electing a government, my choice does not reflect a momentary feeling, but a long and reasoned contemplation of weighty arguments. However, there are many possible trains of arguments I could follow, some of which will cause me to vote Conservative, others to vote Labour, and still others to vote UKIP or just stay at home. What makes me board one train of reasoning rather than another? In the Paddington of my brain, I may be compelled to get on a particular train of reasoning by deterministic processes, or I may embark at random. But I don't freely choose to think those thoughts that will make me vote Conservative. These are not just hypotheses or philosophical speculations. Today we can use brain scanners to predict people's desires and decisions well before they are aware of them. In one kind of experiment, people are placed within a huge brain scanner, holding a switch in each hand. They are asked to press one of the two switches whenever they feel like it. Scientists observing neural activity in the brain can predict which switch the person will press well before the person actually does so, and even before the person is aware of their own intention. Neural events in the brain indicating the person's decision begin from a few hundred milliseconds to a few seconds before the person is aware of this choice. The decision to press either the right or left switch certainly reflected the person's choice, yet it wasn't a free choice. In fact, our belief in free will results from faulty logic. When a biochemical chain reaction makes me desire to press the right switch, I feel that I really want to press the right switch. And this is true. I really want to press it. Yet people erroneously jump to the conclusion that if I want to press it, I choose to want to. This is, of course, false. I don't choose my desires. I only feel them and act accordingly. People nevertheless go on arguing about free will because even scientists all too often continue to use outdated theological concepts. Christian, Muslim, and Jewish theologians debated for centuries the relations between the soul and the will. They assumed that every human has an internal inner essence, called the soul, which is my true self. They further maintained that this self possesses various desires, just as it possesses clothes, vehicles, and houses. I allegedly choose my desires in the same way I choose my clothes, and my fate is determined according to these choices. If I choose good desires, I go to heaven. If I choose bad desires, I am sent to hell. The question then arose, how exactly do I choose my desires? Why, for example, Did Eve desire to eat the forbidden fruit the snake offered her? Was this desire forced upon her? Did this desire just pop up within her by pure chance? Or did she choose it freely? If she didn't choose it freely, why punish her for it? However, once we accept that there is no soul, and that humans have no inner essence called the self, it no longer makes sense to ask, how does the self choose its desires? It's like asking a bachelor, how does your wife choose her clothes? In reality, there is only a stream of consciousness, and desires arise and pass within this stream, but there is no permanent self who owns the desires. Hence it is meaningless to ask whether I choose my desires deterministically, randomly, or freely. It may sound extremely complicated, but it is surprisingly easy to test this idea. Next time a thought pops up in your mind, stop and ask yourself, why did I think this particular thought? Did I decide a minute ago to think this thought, and only then did I think it? Or did it just arise in my mind, without my permission or instruction? If I am indeed the master of my thoughts and decisions, can I decide not to think about anything at all for the next 60 seconds? Just try and see what happens. Doubting free will is not just a philosophical exercise. It has practical implications. If organisms indeed lack free will, it implies we could manipulate and even control their desires using drugs, genetic engineering, or direct brain stimulation. If you want to see philosophy in action, pay a visit to a robo-rat laboratory. A robo-rat is a run-of-the-mill rat with a twist. Scientists have implanted electrodes into the sensory and reward areas in the rat's brain. This enables the scientists to maneuver the rat by remote control. After short training sessions, researchers have managed not only to make the rats turn left or right, but also to climb ladders, sniff around garbage piles, and do things that rats normally dislike, such as jumping from great heights. Armies and corporations show keen interest in the robo-rats, hoping they could prove useful in many tasks and situations. For example, robo-rats could help detect survivors trapped under collapsed buildings, locate bombs and booby traps, and map underground tunnels and caves. Animal welfare activists have voiced concern about the suffering such experiments inflict on the rats. Professor Sanjeev Talwar of the State University of New York, one of the leading robo-rat researchers, has dismissed these concerns, arguing that the rats actually enjoy the experiments. After all, explains Talwar, the rats work for pleasure, and when the electrodes stimulate the reward center in their brain, the rat feels nirvana. To the best of our understanding, the rat doesn't feel that somebody else controls her, and she doesn't feel that she is being coerced to do something against her will. When Professor Talwar presses the remote control, the rat wants to move to the left, which is why she moves to the left. When the professor presses another switch, the rat wants to climb a ladder, which is why she climbs the ladder. After all, the rat's desires are nothing but a pattern of firing neurons. What does it matter whether the neurons are firing because they are stimulated by other neurons, or because they are stimulated by transplanted electrodes connected to Professor Talwar's remote control? If you ask the rat about it, she might well have told you, "Sure, I have free will. Look, I want to turn left, and I turn left. I want to climb a ladder, and I climb a ladder. Doesn't that prove that I have free will?" Experiments performed on Homo sapiens indicate that, like rats, humans too can be manipulated, and that it is possible to create or annihilate even complex feelings such as love, anger, fear, and depression by stimulating the right spots in the human brain. The US military has recently initiated experiments on implanting computer chips in people's brains, hoping to use this method to treat soldiers suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. In Hadassah Hospital in Jerusalem, doctors have pioneered a novel treatment for patients suffering from acute depression. They implant electrodes into the patient's brain and wire the electrodes to a minuscule computer implanted into the patient's breast. On receiving a command from the computer, the electrodes use weak electric currents to paralyze the brain area responsible for the depression. The treatment does not always succeed, but in some cases patients reported that the feeling of dark emptiness that tormented them throughout their lives disappeared as if by magic. One patient complained that several months after the operation he had a relapse and was overcome by severe depression. Upon inspection, the doctors found the source of the problem. The computer's battery had run out of power. Once they changed the battery, the depression quickly melted away. Due to obvious ethical restrictions, researchers implant electrodes into human brains only under special circumstances. Hence, most relevant experiments on humans are conducted using non-intrusive helmet-like devices, technically known as transcranial direct current stimulators. The helmet is fitted with electrodes that attach to the scalp from outside. It produces weak electromagnetic fields and directs them towards specific brain areas, thereby stimulating or inhibiting select brain activities. The American military experiments with such helmets in the hope of sharpening the focus and enhancing the performance of soldiers both in training sessions and on the battlefield. The main experiments are conducted in the Human Effectiveness Directorate, which is located in an Ohio Air Force base. Though the results are far from conclusive, and though the hype around transcranial stimulators currently runs far ahead of actual achievements, several studies have indicated that the method may indeed enhance the cognitive abilities of drone operators, air traffic controllers, snipers, and other personnel whose duties require them to remain highly attentive for extended periods. Sally Adie, a journalist for The New Scientist, was allowed to visit a training facility for snipers and test the effects herself. At first, she entered a battlefield simulator without wearing the transcranial helmet. Sally describes how fear swept over her as she saw 20 masked men, strapped with suicide bombs and armed with rifles, charge straight towards her. "For everyone I managed to shoot dead," writes Sally, "three new assailants pop up from nowhere. I'm clearly not shooting fast enough, and panic and incompetence are making me continually jam my rifle." Luckily for her, the assailants were just video images projected on huge screens all around her. Still, she was so disappointed with her poor performance that she felt like putting down the rifle and leaving the simulator. Then they wired her up to the helmet. She reports feeling nothing unusual, except a slight tingle and a strange metallic taste in her mouth. Yet she began picking off the terrorists one by one, as coolly and methodically as if she were Rambo or Clint Eastwood. "As 20 of them run at me, brandishing their guns, I calmly line up my rifle, take a moment to breathe deeply, and pick off the closest one, before tranquilly assessing my next target. In what seems like next to no time, I hear a voice call out, 'Okay, that's it.' The lights come up in the simulation room. In the sudden quiet amid the bodies around me, I was really expecting more assailants, and I'm a bit disappointed when the team begins to remove my electrodes. I look up and wonder if someone wound the clocks forward. Inexplicably, 20 minutes have just passed. 'How many did I get?' I ask the assistant. She looks at me quizzically. 'All of them.'" The experiment changed Sally's life. In the following days, she realized she has been through a near-spiritual experience. What defined the experience was not feeling smarter or learning faster. The thing that made the earth drop out from under my feet was that, for the first time in my life, everything in my head finally shut up. My brain, without self-doubt, was a revelation. There was suddenly this incredible silence in my head. I hope you can sympathize with me when I tell you that the thing I wanted most acutely for the weeks following my experience was to go back and strap on those electrodes. I also started to have a lot of questions. Who was I, apart from the angry, bitter gnomes that populate my mind and drive me to failure because I'm too scared to try? And where did those voices come from? Some of those voices repeat society's prejudices. Some echo our personal history, and some articulate our genetic legacy. All of them together, says Sally, create an invisible story that shapes our conscious decisions in ways we seldom grasp. What would happen if we could rewrite our inner monologues, or even silence them completely on occasion? As of 2016, transcranial stimulators are still in their infancy, and it is unclear if and when they will become a mature technology. So far, they provide enhanced capabilities for only short durations, and even Sally Adie's 20-minute experience may be quite exceptional, or perhaps even the outcome of the notorious placebo effect. Most published studies of transcranial stimulators are based on very small samples of people operating under special circumstances, and the long-term effects and hazards are completely unknown. However, if the technology does mature, or if some other method is found to manipulate the brain's electric patterns, what would it do to human societies and to human beings? People may well manipulate their brain's electric circuits not just in order to shoot terrorists, but also to achieve more mundane, liberal goals. Namely, to study and work more efficiently, immerse ourselves in games and hobbies, and be able to focus on what interests us at any particular moment, be it maths or football. However, if and when such manipulations become routine, the supposedly free will of customers will become just another product we can buy. You want to master the piano, but whenever practice time comes, you actually prefer to watch television? No problem. Just put on the helmet, install the right software, and you will be downright aching to play the piano. You may counter-argue that the ability to silence or enhance the voices in your head will actually strengthen rather than undermine your free will. Presently, you often fail to realize your most cherished and authentic desires due to external distractions. With the help of the attention helmet and similar devices, you could more easily silence the alien voices of priests, spin doctors, advertisers, and neighbors, and focus on what you want. However, as we will shortly see, the notion that you have a single self and that you could therefore distinguish your authentic desires from alien voices is just another liberal myth, debunked by the latest scientific research. Who are I? Science undermines not only the liberal belief in free will, but also the belief in individualism. Liberals believe that we have a single and indivisible self. To be an individual means that I am individual. Yes, my body is made up of approximately 37 trillion cells, and each day both my body and my mind go through countless permutations and transformations. Yet if I really pay attention and strive to get in touch with myself, I am bound to discover deep inside a single clear and authentic voice, which is my true self, and which is the source of all meaning and authority in the universe. For liberalism to make sense, I must have one and only one true self. For if I had more than one authentic voice, how would I know which voice to heed in the polling station, in the supermarket, and in the marriage market? However, over the last few decades, the life sciences have reached the conclusion that this liberal story is pure mythology. The single authentic self is as real as the eternal Christian soul, Santa Claus, and the Easter Bunny. If you look really deep within yourself, the seeming unity that we take for granted dissolves into a cacophony of conflicting voices, none of which is my true self. Humans aren't individuals. They are individuals. The human brain is composed of two hemispheres, connected to each other through a thick neural cable. Each hemisphere controls the opposite side of the body. The right hemisphere controls the left side of the body, receives data from the left-hand field of vision, and is responsible for moving the left arm and leg, and vice versa. This is why people who have had a stroke in their right hemisphere sometimes ignore the left side of their body, combing only the right side of their hair, or eating only the food placed on the right side of their plate. There are also emotional and cognitive differences between the two hemispheres, though the division is far from clear-cut. Most cognitive activities involve both hemispheres, but not to the same degree. For example, in most cases the left hemisphere plays a more important role in speech and in logical reasoning, whereas the right hemisphere is more dominant in processing spatial information. Many breakthroughs in understanding the relations between the two hemispheres were based on the study of epilepsy patients. In severe cases of epilepsy, Electrical storms begin in one part of the brain but quickly spread to other parts, causing a very acute seizure. During such seizures, patients lose control of their body, and frequent seizures consequently prevent patients from holding a job or leading a normal lifestyle. In the mid-20th century, when all other treatments failed, doctors alleviated the problem by cutting the thick neural cable connecting the two hemispheres, so that electrical storms beginning in one hemisphere could not spill over to the other. For brain scientists, these patients were a goldmine of astounding data. Some of the most notable studies on these split-brain patients were conducted by Professor Roger Walcott Sperry, who won the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine for his groundbreaking discoveries, and by his student, Professor Michael S. Gazzaniga. One study was conducted on a teenaged boy. The boy was asked what he would like to do when he grew up. The boy answered that he wanted to be a draftsman. This answer was provided by the left hemisphere, which plays a crucial part in logical reasoning as well as in speech. Yet the boy had another active speech center in his right hemisphere, which could not control vocal language, but could spell words using Scrabble tiles. The researchers were keen to know what the right hemisphere would say. So they spread Scrabble tiles on the table, and then took a piece of paper and wrote on it, "What would you like to do when you grow up?" They placed the paper at the edge of the boy's left visual field. Data from the left visual field is processed in the right hemisphere. Since the right hemisphere could not use vocal language, the boy said nothing. But his left hand began moving rapidly across the table, collecting tiles from here and there. It spelled out, "Automobile race." Spooky. Equally eerie behavior was displayed by patient W.J., a Second World War veteran. W.J.'s hands were each controlled by a different hemisphere. Since the two hemispheres were out of touch with one another, it sometimes happened that his right hand would reach out to open a door, and then his left hand would intervene and try to slam the door shut. In another experiment, Gazzaniga and his team flashed a picture of a chicken claw to the left half-brain, the side responsible for speech, and simultaneously flashed a picture of a snowy landscape to the right brain. When asked what they saw, patients invariably answered, "A chicken claw." Gazzaniga then presented one patient, P.S., with a series of picture cards and asked him to point to the one that best matched what he had seen. The patient's right hand, controlled by his left brain, pointed to a picture of a chicken, but simultaneously his left hand shot out and pointed to a snow shovel. Gazzaniga then asked P.S. the million-dollar question. "Why did you point to both the chicken and to the shovel?" P.S. replied, "Oh, the chicken claw goes with the chicken, and you need a shovel to clean out the chicken shed." What happened here? The left brain, which controls speech, had no data about the snow scene, and therefore did not really know why the left hand pointed to the shovel. So it just invented something credible. After repeating this experiment many times, Gazzaniga concluded that the left hemisphere of the brain is the seat not only of our verbal abilities, but also of an internal interpreter that constantly tries to make sense of our life, using partial clues in order to concoct plausible stories. In another experiment, the non-verbal right hemisphere was shown a pornographic image. The patient reacted by blushing and giggling. "What did you see?" asked the mischievous researchers. "Nothing. Just a flash of light," said the left hemisphere, and the patient immediately giggled again, covering her mouth with her hand. "Why are you laughing, then?" they insisted. The bewildered left hemisphere interpreter, struggling for some rational explanation, replied that one of the machines in the room looked very funny. It's as if the CIA conducts a drone strike in Pakistan, unbeknown to the U.S. State Department. When a journalist grills State Department officials about it, they make up some plausible explanation. In reality, the spin doctors don't have a clue why the strike was ordered, so they just invent something. A similar mechanism is employed by all human beings, not just by split-brain patients. Again and again, my own private CIA does things without the approval or knowledge of my State Department, and then my State Department cooks up a story that presents me in the best possible light. Often enough, the State Department itself becomes convinced of the pure fantasies it has invented. Similar conclusions have been reached by behavioral economists who want to know how people take economic decisions, or more accurately, who takes these decisions. Who decides to buy a Toyota rather than a Mercedes, to go on holiday to Paris rather than Thailand, and to invest in South Korean treasury bonds rather than in the Shanghai Stock Exchange? Most experiments have indicated that there is no single self making any of these decisions. Rather, they result from a tug of war between different and often conflicting inner entities. One groundbreaking experiment was conducted by Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics. Kahneman asked a group of volunteers to join a three-part experiment. In the short part of the experiment, the volunteers inserted one hand into a container filled with water at 14 degrees Celsius for 1 minute, which is unpleasant, bordering on painful. After 60 seconds, they were told to take their hand out. In the long part of the experiment, volunteers placed their other hand in another water container. The temperature there was also 14 degrees Celsius, but after 60 seconds, hot water was secretly added into the container, bringing the temperature up to 15 degrees Celsius. 30 seconds later, they were told to pull out their hand. Some volunteers did the short part first, while others began with the long part. In either case, exactly 7 minutes after both parts were over, came the third and most important part of the experiment. The volunteers were told they must repeat one of the two parts, and it was up to them to choose which. 80% preferred to repeat the long experiment, remembering it as less painful. The cold water experiment is so simple, yet its implications shake the core of the liberal worldview. It exposes the existence of at least two different selves within us, the experiencing self and the narrating self. The experiencing self is our moment-to-moment consciousness. For the experiencing self, it's obvious that the long part of the cold water experiment was worse. First, you experience water at 14 degrees Celsius for 60 seconds, which is every bit as bad as what you experience in the short part, and then you must endure another 30 seconds of water at 15 degrees Celsius, which is not quite as bad, but still far from pleasant. For the experiencing self, it is impossible that adding a slightly unpleasant experience to a very unpleasant experience will make the entire episode more appealing. However, the experiencing self remembers nothing. It tells no stories and is seldom consulted when it comes to big decisions. Retrieving memories, telling stories, and making big decisions are all the monopoly of a very different entity inside us, the narrating self. The narrating self is akin to Gazzaniga's left brain interpreter. It is forever busy spinning yarns about the past and making plans for the future. Like every journalist, poet, and politician, the narrating self takes many shortcuts. It doesn't narrate everything, and usually weaves the story only from peak moments and end results. The value of the whole experience is determined by averaging peaks with ends. For example, in the short part of the cold water experiment, the narrating self finds the average between the worst part, the water was very cold, and the last moment, the water was still very cold, and concludes that the water was very cold. The narrating self does the same thing with the long part of the experiment. It finds the average between the worst part, the water was very cold, and the last moment, the water was not so cold, and concludes that the water was somewhat warmer. Crucially, the narrating self is duration blind, giving no importance to the differing lengths of the two parts. So, when it has a choice between the two, it prefers to repeat the long part, the one in which the water was somewhat warmer. Every time the narrating self evaluates our experiences, it discounts their duration and adopts the peak-end rule. It remembers only the peak moment and the end moment, and evaluates the whole experience according to their average. This has far-reaching impact on all our practical decisions. Kahneman began investigating the experiencing self and the narrating self in the early 1990s, when, together with Donald Redlmeyer of the University of Toronto, he studied colonoscopy patients. In colonoscopy tests, A tiny camera is inserted into the guts through the anus in order to diagnose various bowel diseases. It is not a pleasant experience. Doctors want to know how to perform the test in the least painful way. Should they speed up the colonoscopy?